How about that weather, folks? It is a lame way to start a conversation, I'll give you that, but in Kansas City, it carries a hint of suspense. And if you think cities everywhere are basically equal in that regard, think again. The data aggregating website 538 has compiled a statistically driven list of U.S. cities with the most unpredictable weather. Their first list turned up municipalities with very little population, which makes sense when you think about why people cluster where they do. So then they narrowed it down to the 50 most populous cities, and guess who came in first? That's right, Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about why that is, how it affects our lives, and what you do to live with it. 816-235-2888 is the number to call if unpredictable weather plays out in a significant way in your life. Does it change your work schedule, your livelihood? Do you have tried and trusted ways of guessing what the weather will be like that you think the rest of us should adopt? 816-235-2888. Right now, I am joined by Brian Busby, chief meteorologist at KMBC 9 News, although he probably doesn't really need that introduction. Hi, Brian.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. A little cold.
You looked a little surprised when I shared that little info.
I just want to know exactly how they came up with it. You know, did they base it on misses, inaccuracy being the most difficult? So I'm just wondering how we ranked at
They are top. Not evaluating meteorologists.
Right.
And I should say that I would take that as a great compliment to anyone who works here as a meteorologist, because basically they explain in some detail how they came up with that, and I'll be happy to share it with you sometime, although it is a little bit over my head as a non-specialist.
Okay.
I'll admit that. They said basically like those first cities that they came up with that were less populated were mostly in the upper Midwest and Great Plains.
Okay.
So anyway.
Huh.
Do you think of Kansas City's weather as especially hard to predict?
I think it's varied, that's for sure, in that you can actually have maybe three or four of your seasons within 1 week. So we get a lot of swings. And I think we get a lot of variance just because where we're located. And, you know, realtors talk about location, location, location. And I think because we're right dab smack in the middle, I think that's also why they put it like an information booth in the middle of a mall in case you're lost. Well, a lot of weather gets lost and comes to Kansas City.
What do you mean by that? How does weather get lost?
Here's what I mean. If you go across the northern portion of the United States, it's mostly cold. International Falls, mostly cold. If you go down toward Brownsville, Texas, mostly warm. But the I-70 corridor gets a little mix in weather, can sometimes hit you directly with cold air coming down and stays for days, or it just gives you a glancing blow and then retreats back up to Canada. Same thing with the warm air. So because we're in the center of the United States, it's kind of like Neapolitan ice cream. The top, always hot. The middle, a mix. And the bottom, always cold. I'm going to try again. Top, cold. Middle, mix. Bottom, very warm. So I think that's what I mean by weather gets lost, in that it's percolating, it's forming. And Andy and I were talking before coming in here that
we've got another guest, Andy Bailey.
Yes,
and we'll
yes.
be speaking with him shortly.
That he has more experience. My entire professional career has been in Missouri, so I don't know any better, but I would say it is pretty challenging being here for the 33 years I've been in Kansas City and the 7 I was in St. Louis. It's pretty tough in the center of the country, mainly west of the Mississippi, I would say. But again, that's my perspective. But my colleague, and Andy and I have been friends for a while, he shed some light that I just didn't think of. So,
well, okay, let's bring in Andy Bailey. Andy joins us from the National Weather Service. He's the warning coordination meteorologist stationed here in Kansas City. And Andy, what does that mean, first of all, warning coordination meteorologist?
What it really means is I spend a great deal of my time coordinating the services the National Weather Service offers with folks like Brian in the broadcast industry, with emergency managers that are working in every community and county around our forecast area, really to make sure that they can use what we're producing, they know how to use it, that we're producing the right things. So I'm coordinating the services that we produce to make sure it's useful for all of our partners.
And you're doing that especially when people need to be warned about the weather.
Yeah, certainly the communications occur year-round, but they really ramp up before and during active weather.
So, like, it seems to me that you are kind of the enemy of surprise. You're trying to keep people from being caught off guard by the weather. they might be caught off guard when things are happening very unpredictably, but you have the perspective that it's not that hard to predict.
Well, no, I'm saying I think the weather is very difficult to predict, especially when it gets active and when it matters most. Weather is very difficult to predict. However, when you go around the country, this is the fourth National Weather Service office I've been in, and I don't want to say there's some place that I've worked that's harder than here, but every place has had its forecast challenges. When you go further west and you have mountain ranges, that when you have to start thinking in three dimensions as far as the impacts to people as you go up in elevation, becomes very difficult. And the computer models, which we all rely on to help guide us in our forecasts, really don't do a good job in mountainous areas. Same thing for coastal areas. Even a place like San Diego, you might think, come on, it's 70 degrees and partly sunny every single day. How tough can it be? Well, the forecasters at the National Weather Service there are forecasting conditions for the airports. And if they produce a bad forecast of when the low clouds and fog that seem to occur every single day there, when they finally erode, if they're off, that's going to cause quite a bit of expense for airlines and delayed flights. And so,
but I mean, we have an airport too. That's just on top of all the other stuff that's hard to predict for like the layperson who's waking up like, what am I going to wear today? And like that basic question can be fraught with complication here.
Sure, it can, and I think that's a fair comment. I can tell you when I worked in Rapid City, when I first moved there, it was October, and I never knew how to dress every day because it would start out. It was October, and it would start out in the upper 20s, and by the time I'd get off work, it'd be 75. Mm-hmm. So I would leave the house with a winter coat on and come home in short sleeves, and it was a really weird thing to have such a huge swing in the weather. And once you live there a couple of years, you just kind of get used to it. You don't wear the coat quite as much as you should. And
you do some more sprinting to your car.
Somewhat, yeah.
Okay, so, but Brian, I mean, when you think about what is unpredictable about Kansas City weather, I mean, so it sounds like we have our flatness, our relative flatness going for us in that people are basically experiencing the same weather within the city, barring like a tornado, something like that would affect one tiny area of town in a particular way that the rest of us don't quite experience. But mostly, one person in Kansas City is experiencing the same weather as another person in Kansas City in the way that cities with variable elevation, that might not be true?
Well, certainly, just think of the Front Range in Colorado. And if you are forecasting the weather in Denver, you know, that's one thing. But as you go up in elevation, not only is the weather going to change significantly, but the guidance that we get to help us forecast is more and more inaccurate. And so it's not giving us as good a guidance when you get into those mountainous areas. And it does make it quite a bit more challenging.
I think also it's just perspective in that, you know, we have tried to pinpoint our forecasts. In the old days, we would say sunny with a chance of rain. But now you guys ask, okay, what time is it going to start? What time is it going to stop?
Yeah, I need an hourly breakdown.
Pretty much. And the other thing is people want to know, is my soccer game with my child in Lee Wood going to be rained on? Or is it in Lee Summit? And I can be right for Lee Summit and say, yeah, you're going to be clear, and wrong for Lee Wood with that same forecast because it rained. And the science is just not that accurate to be able to pinpoint each and every acre. Because how many times do we drive down the street, we use our intermittent windshield wipers for three city blocks, it's sunny, and nowhere else is it raining. No forecast that anybody gives you will say that between College and 135th, between Quivira, we can't do that. We cannot pinpoint that far. The models that Andy's talking about are just not that refined.
And plus, when would you sleep if you were figuring all of that out?
You wouldn't.
Okay, so Brian Busby, I just as a human being moving through this city, have you ever found yourself just like flabbergasted by what is happening with the weather on a single day?
Oh, sure. Like,
can you tell a story about that?
Well, honestly, you know, when we give forecasts out, prime example was probably fresh in everybody's mind was yesterday morning. Impacts. I mean, we can still say the forecast is going to be for snow, and it was snowing. But depending on what happens to treated surfaces, non-treated surfaces, how people react, and you can't really govern how people drive. There are some people who still think they have a huge truck and they have 4x4, but friction and gravity don't really help give you immunity on ice. And so a lot of it has to do with how something as simple as just 1 inch of snow can cause a myriad of problems depending on how other people react to it. So you can be right on paper meteorologically, but still, because of the impacts of how people react to it, by saying maybe in the back of their mind, oh, it's just 1 inch of snow. And when you just dismiss it like that, then people let their guard down. And when people let their guard down, then things happen.
Can you also talk about, I mean, I know meteorologists get a lot of feedback, and I'm wondering when it comes to weather predictability, there are people who work in fields where weather actually like can be a big deal to them. Are there professions of people who you hear from in really high numbers just because of how much is at stake for them? Or do people who work outdoors tend to develop their own sort of prediction methods, unofficial, maybe unscientific?
I think if they do work outside, they're going to have their own. And, you know, I'm not arrogant enough to think that people do not shop and get a second opinion. I'm sure they watch Gary and watch the other Gary on 5 and Mike Thompson and me and the Weather Channel and the AccuWeather Channel and CNN and Fox. All these different folks give forecasts. And by the time you can synthesize all that, you may have two or three different solutions. And then you talk to your friends, it becomes a fishtail. So, I would say that probably anybody who's working in outdoors like landscaping or anybody who's building a house wants to pour concrete, anything where temperature and humidity and wind, yeah, those are the people I hear from.
Okay, well, just a little more time to call 816-235-2888 and talk about the weather. I know you want to. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to this conversation about what makes Kansas City weather unpredictable and how it affects our lives. 816-235-2888. Brian Busby, Andy Bailey, welcome back to KCUR Central Standard.
Thank you.
Hey, good to be here.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We are talking about the weather, and Brian Busby, you were just saying that it's no coincidence that complete strangers can talk about the weather.
It's an equalizer because it affects everybody. And, unless you are a relative of one of the chiefs, what happens at Arrowhead doesn't directly affect you. Unless one of your relatives is serving his or her country in the Middle East, directly that does not affect you. But do I need to scrape frost off my windshield? That directly affects you. And if you had to scrape it and you didn't think you had to scrape it in the elevator, you can talk to a stranger and say, where'd that frost come from? So it is a great equalizer for sure.
Andy, what are your thoughts about just the way we talk about the weather?
You know, it's interesting to me because I grew up on a farm in northern Iowa. And certainly in a farm, weather's going to impact every single thing you do. And that's all people talked about, right? And as I traveled around working in different parts of the country, weather's not necessarily a big topic the way it is here in the Midwest. And people really – Brian's exactly right. People do talk about the weather constantly, especially when they don't have a lot in common. So I find that interesting, and maybe for me, giving my upbringing a little reassuring too, if it does feel like home.
Well, let's talk to some of our callers. We've got people who have some feedback, not just on the unpredictability of Kansas City weather, but on perhaps the illusion that it can be predicted with 100% guarantee. Chris in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to the show.
Hi. It seems silly to a lot of people, but we do flat roofing work, and we'll have a building open. This happened to us on three different occasions. We have 0% chance of precipitation or a storm, and we get plastered. And I'm just wondering, there's two issues out there. One, is it possible to give us more up-to-date weather reports throughout the day rather than just one forecast that covers the whole area? And two, KCUR in particular is guilty of this. KCUR has no weather forecast, so we're forced to go off-channel to listen to someone else. When we listen to KCUR all day, and even on other radio stations, we don't get up-to-date weather forecasts.
Though we do appreciate that you're listening all day.
Well, yeah, but I can't if you're not putting the weather on there or the time. But is there any way to get us more up-to-date forecasts? Because it can be dangerous for us up there if the forecasts are wrong.
Okay, so it's dangerous for some people to have a misleading report or just a report that has changed since last they were able to access new information. And particularly, he's talking about being a flat roof contractor. But so I'll let you respond to that. But also, a detail in his story that intrigues me is the 0% chance. So 0% chances and 100% chances of anything seem very risky for a meteorologist. Have you ever given one?
100% chance?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you feel confident enough to do it?
Well, you don't do it 5 days out. You only do it about 3 hours out. If you see this huge blob on radar that's going all the way from the Iowa state line down to Oklahoma and there are no gaps in it, it's a pretty good bet that probably you're going to run into it. So that's a pretty good 100% chance. But it's only a forecast for 6 hours. I'm betting that this thing is not going to deteriorate in 6 hours. There's no way I'm going to get a 100% chance 5 or 6 days out.
You know, I don't remember the source on this, but in my own life, I've changed plans based on 100% prediction. And I don't remember who the meteorologist was. 100% chance of snow, like heavy snow. And my mom was supposed to drive from Iowa to Kansas City for Hanukkah. And we canceled those plans because we didn't want her stuck in the snow. It didn't snow. And that really got me thinking about, like, whoa, 100%. That takes guts.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to address the caller's question. And one of the things that both Brian and I are charged with doing is producing forecasts for everyone. It's hard to be specific for an individual user when you're charged with, for Brian, it's his market area that he has to forecast for all of those
counties.
44 counties. And for me, it's 44 counties that we forecast and warn for. But there is an entire weather enterprise out there of private meteorological forecasting firms that do exactly what the caller was asking, give me a site-specific forecast with very specific precipitation thresholds, start time, stop time, amount. And there's an entire world out there of private forecasting firms that are chomping at the bit to try to get the kind of business that he's looking for.
Yeah. And talking about how radio stations, a disc jockey, when they prepare, they want to have their lines and their shtick more so than the forecast. So they'll just probably go to a website and not update it. And who knows, maybe the weather service has updated the forecast, but they just want to read it over that intro of a song, cloudy with a chance of showers, you know, and they just want to fit it in to their programming without much regard for the accuracy of the forecast. So I guess there are some areas where you can get that sort of information more updated. I think the social media has helped. Just vet who you're getting the information from, because I call them mediaologists, M-E-D-I-A, mediaologists as opposed to meteorologists. Some of us are trained in it. Some of us are just looking for the likes and the shares.
Can you explain what I feel like this is just true of everything in every aspect of journalism, where there's some field within it that has expertise, and now that social media has made everyone a broadcaster, understanding what the expertise brings to it might be a little bit muddy for an average consumer. So can you explain what your expertise allows you to do?
I think what it does is it allows you to have a gut. It allows you to have an educated guess more so than just rolling a dice or looking at a Ouija board. We are basing this on science. We're basing it on what the atmosphere, how it behaves, and what should happen. And the analogy I use is everybody has seen somebody fill out a Final Four bracket, and it's based on what's happened in the past. And you base your forecast on what's happened in the past, and that's what we do. But once we commit it to paper, it's out of our hands. Referee makes a bad call, therefore your bracket blows up. Your star player gets injured in the second half. That bracket breaks up. But you can't anticipate all those variables when you first come up with your forecast. And Andy talks about last week at the IWT, what he's talking about, he brings in emergency managers, broadcasters, because we have the largest megaphone, and the weather service. And the three of us try to work together to speak with one voice so that there's no ambiguity between what we're saying. And that way you can hopefully weed out the folks who are going for 15 inches of snow 25 days out that you see on social media.
Right? The way you talk about the weather, though, this might sound strange, but it's almost like the weather is alive. Do you think of the weather as being alive?
Huh. You know, maybe not alive, but it's almost like the weather has a choice, or because we're forecasting the weather and the weather didn't cooperate. Or, you know, the forecast is one thing, but the actual weather is something different.
Right.
And so maybe...
Because when you talk about, like, referees making a call or someone getting injured, like, all of the unpredictability of a living thing, it sounds like can be attributed to weather.
Well, yeah, I guess we do kind of anthropomorphize the weather and give it, like, well, with hurricanes, she's moving here, you know, as opposed to it's moving on shore. I think in its life cycle, because it is something that starts off as a little moisture, becomes a cloud, becomes a thunderstorm, becomes maybe a tornado, and then weakens, it does have a life cycle. And in that regard, I guess it is a living organism. So it does ebb, it does flow, it does mature, and it decays, much like a living organism. I don't think it has eyes, nose, and a mouth, but it does breathe in, breathe out, and I guess that's one way of looking at it. So, yeah, I guess so.
Let's talk to Nancy, just bringing us back to this question of the particularities of Kansas City and how that might be similar or different from other places, even places very nearby. Nancy in Excelsior Springs, good morning.
Good morning. I grew up in St. Louis, but I have now lived close to Kansas City for 40 years. But when I moved here, I thought, gosh, it just seems like it's so much windier here than on the east side of the state. And I was just wondering if that's true or if, you know, if it has something to do with it's flat till it gets to Kansas City, then we start having more hills between here and St. Louis.
Well, let's get some feedback on this. Nancy has just a personal experience of more windiness in Kansas City than St. Louis. And Brian, you have been a meteorologist in both Kansas City and St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Is that something you notice?
Not readily that I notice per se, but I take that back that sometimes when a storm system moves in, or actually after it moves out, you can get 40-mile-an-hour winds behind a cold front. I don't remember seeing that as much in St. Louis. I don't think you can point to just one thing and say that's why. I think it's a combination of many things. Geography certainly is one of them. Andy, of course, has lived in mountains and in the northern plains. Is there just something?
You know, there might be something to that. Just we're further west. I know when I worked in Rapid City, extraordinarily windy mm-hmm. the further west on the high plains. And I'm wondering if we're in kind of that transition between the Midwest and the plains. And so maybe there's some merit to what she's observed.
It's interesting that what feels like such a short distance between two places could make a weather difference. Brian?
If you take a map of the United States and you draw a straight line due south of Dodge City, Kansas, you'll hit Mexico. If you do that exact same experiment and draw a line due south of Kansas City, you hit this little lip of the Gulf of Mexico. And since weather is made up of moisture, that difference that you're talking about between Dodge City and Kansas City makes all the difference in the world. There's one thing that Andy and I and other meteorologists look at in the spring, and especially in severe weather season, called the dry line, that you'll get thunderstorms that form where you have a difference of high humidity and arid conditions. And that's enough to make these thunderstorms just spark. So I think that because of our location being as unique as it is in the center of the country, not too hot, not too cold, and also a little more humid than out over the Western Plains. Those ingredients coming together can really make a dynamic difference over a short period of time.
Do you have a forecast to share with us for something that might happen in Kansas City weather in the near future? You don't like pop quizzes, huh?
I think we can expect to see a transition back to normal or above normal temperatures maybe a week from now. Maybe towards Thanksgiving and then into the Thanksgiving weekend.
It should not be as cold for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I think those people waiting outside for Black Friday shopping in a week and a half might be a little more happy than they would be if they were doing it today.
There you go.
There you have it. Brian Busby, Chief Meteorologist at KNBC Channel 9, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Andy Bailey of the National Weather Service, thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Up next, the first Open Spaces Festival is over. It was ambitious. It was highly anticipated. So how'd it go? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for that discussion. We're back. back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're talking about Open Spaces, the citywide arts festival that took place from August to October. They had a killer lineup of national artists and local artists, people who are well known like Janelle Monáe, but also under-recognized artists here in town who got a special chance to shine. It was every art form, every kind of venue, from big theaters and museums to decommissioned churches and city parks, specifically Swope Park, the festival hub. So you can understand why a lot of us couldn't quite imagine what it would be like before it happened. Well, now that it's happened, what do people think? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. That's 816-235-2888. Let's start by introducing our guests. Mo Dickens, good morning.
Morning, Gina.
You work at the Belger, a gallery and art center, but you also attended Open Spaces with abandon, and that is the role that I am particularly intrigued by.
Yeah, I made it my goal to try to see everything, which I didn't make it. But I gave it a good shot, and I probably saw 90%.
So what is, tell us about what that project was like. How much time and energy did you have to devote to seeing 90% of the festival?
A lot. And when I say that, I mean the visual arts part of it. I didn't see that many of the performances. I work Wednesday through Saturday, and so Saturday afternoons, there was stuff going on out there at the pavilion, and I didn't get to see any of those performances. But I did see some of the ones on Sunday, and I was introduced to Mooka Patsa, which is one of my new favorite bands. I was introduced to Daka Braka from the Ukraine, another one of my new favorite bands, these people I'd never heard of before Open Spaces. And so the visual arts, I know pretty well, and I thought I knew the venues, but Dan Cameron found some venues that I did not have a clue about, like the church that Nick Cave used at Linwood and Benton.
So talk about that experience. That was a very popular one. And in fact, I have some numbers here. And that installation, High Dive, saw an average of 100 visitors a day over the course of Open Spaces. That's 100 people a day going to a church that many of them had never heard of.
Yeah, and that was a beautiful thing. And 100 people a day probably doesn't sound like that much, but it actually is. When we do a show down at Belger, we'll have a big crowd at opening, like most art galleries. And then you walk in the next Saturday afternoon, the very next day, and you might have a half a dozen people. So getting 100 people every day, 6 days a week, like they were doing.
Well, that's an average, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a good turnout. It's a real good turnout. And for me personally, I went 7 times. I finally found a church I wanted to attend, and it was Nick Cave's church. And since he had gone to the Kansas City Art Institute, he was a local hero. I really loved it. He turned out to be one of the stars of the show. I mean, he really brought us something unique, and it was a very special thing. And now it's over. I would tell people, go see it, because it's not going to exist when Open Spaces stops.
What is it that you experienced there for people who didn't go, don't know about Nick Cave?
Well, it was in a real Catholic church, an abandoned church at this point. And I went that first weekend, and I parked outside, and there was no signs in those days, so it looked like an abandoned church. And I parked on the wrong side, and I shook every darn door on that church trying to find the entrance. And finally, I got in the front door, and it was deathly quiet. And then I opened the vestibule door, and all heck was breaking loose. Your producer told me not to cuss on the air, but it was quite.
We advise against that.
Yeah, it was quite a moment when you walk in there and there's water rushing across the floor. There's like giant chicken heads and giant eyeballs winking at you and flashing on the walls of the walls of the church. And then there's that giant lifeguard's chair up there at the far end up there. And you walk up there and you still see the mosaics from the church days. And it was just so much going on. It was such an intense experience.
So it sounds like that's a highlight of Open Spaces for you, Mo Dickens.
Yeah.
What is there something that you would consider a low? And I know that no one like owes anything to anyone in this sense, but like, you can leave an art experience unfulfilled and that's nobody's fault necessarily. But is there anything where like what was happening didn't match the attendance like it ought to have, or like where something just felt underpromoted, or like sort of measurably unfulfilled in some way?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask that, because nothing thrills me more than to have one visitor show up at the Belcher. Like, this actually happened yesterday, and we spend an hour and a half walking through the show, and we have a conversation about the work. And so I don't get upset if there's not 1,000 people in the audience. I will say that that weekend when Mother Nature really wreaked havoc on the weekend out at Starlight.
The weekend, we'll get into in a minute, but yeah.
Yeah, well, so the jazz stuff got moved to the gym, and Daca Braca got moved to the Mutual Musicians Foundation. And that's where they should have been anyway. I mean, it was indoors. It was, you know, in the Jazz District of Kansas City. And even the MC down there at the gym said Mother Nature knew what she was doing. She put the jazz stuff in the jazz neighborhood. And Vijay Iyer said it meant so much to him to walk into the Mutual Musicians Foundation and play on the piano that so many greats have played on. And so, if those crowds had been non-crowds, had been in Starlight, it would have looked horrible. But they look nice and cozy where they were, especially at the Mutual Musicians Foundation. That was just a wonderful event.
Let's get more into the weekend now. I want to bring in April Fleming. She's a freelance reporter here in town, and she covered the weekend at Starlight for The Pitch. Hi, April.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So start by explaining what the weekend was.
So the weekend was this really big, ambitious weekend-long concert out at Starlight that was headlined on Friday by The Roots, and then on Saturday by Kansas City's own Janelle Monáe, and then Vijay Iyer on Sunday. It was, like I said, yeah, just a huge, big, ambitious concert that it's still pretty amazing to me was put on in part by the city.
So talk to me about what you would consider like the high points of the weekend and like the real successes of the weekend, and maybe some of the lows.
I think that the high point, you know, quite obviously was getting Janelle Monáe to headline this. So she's a pop star from Kansas City, Kansas, who right now is kind of at the height of her power. She's a protege of Prince, and she just released an album called Dirty Computer. And like I said, she's kind of at the height of her power with, you know, a lot of singles that have come out lately. She's just this really powerful African-American artist who's just maybe the best headliner that they could possibly hope for.
And she delivered on her sort of like the idea of a homecoming, the way she spoke to Kansas City specifically. I was there. It was an amazing thing.
Absolutely. And she had her... she had a lot of family there. She had teachers there from KCK. It was truly a homecoming.
So what would you say was a low of the weekend?
I think a low was probably the attendance, particularly on Friday night for The Roots and the other local artists who were there with The Roots. I think that was in part due to the regular draw of those bands, perhaps. I think the last time that The Roots played, they played... at, I think it was at a casino in North Kansas City, and they brought about 1,000 people, which I think they brought about that to Starlight. But I also think that the event was not particularly well promoted early, you know, in advance. You did see some billboards, you did see, you know, some advertisements on the radio and on television leading up to it, but those were, you know, very close to the event. And so I don't think that it was particularly well promoted and in a way that was easy to understand.
Was there, I have wondered about this. I mean, I was excited about the lineup, but then I also wondered in advance, and kind of this became amplified later. Just was there too much going on that it was almost competing for people's attention? I mean, I know it seems like the idea was that people would really make a weekend of this. Not everyone can do that. The ticket prices didn't necessarily lend themselves to that, depending on your income. But more so just, did the offerings of the festival itself end up kind of competing with one another for people's time and attention and maybe the focus of promotion?
I think so. Yeah, like you said, the ticket prices may have been a barrier that was too high for a lot of people to go over. The ticket prices started at, I think, $40. And when you add fees, that's, you know, over $100 for two people. And that's per night. And so if you're talking about going to both or all three of those shows, that's pretty expensive. And that's, you know, out of reach for most people in town. So, yeah, I think it would have been difficult to draw really heavily on both nights. There were other concerts in town those two nights as well. There was Foo Fighters, I think, on Friday and Ed Sheeran on Saturday. Ed Sheeran obviously drew something like 50,000 people out to Arrowhead. And I don't know what the, you know, crossover in those audiences are. I don't know if there's a ton of crossover between people that want to go see Ed Sheeran and then people that want to go see Janelle Monáe, but surely there is some.
You know, the Friday night show with the Roots headlining, one of the opening acts, Mo has mentioned before, Vijay Iyer, a really big deal in jazz right now. My husband went to that show, and in the hours before the Roots came, this sort of nationally recognized big deal of a performer, it's cold out, and like the photos he showed me from the evening, like no one was there. And he was just kind of like waved on to the front and they were like, everyone raise your hands up. And he was like, I'm the only one in the front row trying to like wave his hands as big as he possibly can so they don't feel bad. You know, that's what do you make of something like that?
It was even a little disheartening to see when you walked in, you know, anyone that came in to see the Roots, they did push everyone towards that orchestra section. And so thankfully it was, you know, full right around the stage. But I think even for the opening acts, you know, there may have been a couple hundred people there, which in a different venue looks one way, but at Starlight, which has a capacity of about 8,000, it looks pretty bad. And so, it's got to be, it's tough for an audience member to see, and it's got to be disheartening for the artist on stage to look out and see so many empty seats.
In your writing about this on The Pitch, you said that you hoped the city didn't lose its shirt on this.
Yes, I think that this was such an ambitious festival in so many ways, you know, from the visual arts aspect to the music. And typically what spells financial ruin for a festival is just going way too big out of the gate. And I think without perhaps an education component, I think this festival was a little bit confusing for some people. What is this? And, you know, just going so big the first year that they tried to do something like that, I don't have the numbers. I don't know how it panned out for the city, but I really can't imagine that this was financially successful.
And your concern about it, it seems like, is coming from a place of excitement over what it was and hoping for it to be successful.
I did love it. You know, like Mo, I thought that Nick Cave exhibit was powerful and beautiful. And I also really liked a couple of the arts exhibits that were local from Sean Bitters and Julian Youngbird. And there was a really popular exhibit also out at Swope Park by Ebony Patterson. You know, and as well as the musical performances, I thought they brought out great artists and they had really great taste in, you know, a lot of ways. I think it was cool to have an event that was predominantly in the east side of the city, in, you know, neighborhoods a lot of people don't often make it to. But I also think that it was, like I said, maybe a little overly ambitious and perhaps underpromoted in a way that depressed turnout and maybe spelled that this might not happen again.
Or if not underpromoted, perhaps confusingly promoted.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay, I want to give a little background here. We've given this on previous shows, but just to make sure everyone's all caught up, the background on the festival, 8 years ago, Mayor Sly James, with lots of input from lots of people, created a cultural office for Kansas City and a cultural plan for Kansas City. Spelled out in that plan was that he wanted a citywide arts festival with a hub in Swope Park. And he wanted that for a lot of reasons. And so this is, Open Spaces turns out in some ways to be the fulfillment of that plan, but it also sort of converged with private philanthropists' plan for a citywide festival as well. So there's a public-private partnership at work here. Early on in the process, we spoke about what it would be with Consuelo Cruz, who's with the city's cultural office. And here's what she said about why do a festival. So this festival was ambitious in a lot of ways. One of the ways is that it wasn't just like a 3-day festival. It was 2 months long. So part of it is that the effort is spread out over all this time. And here's what she said about why that was.
I think a two-month festival gives people the opportunity to experience art in different ways. I think traditionally we've had three-day festivals or one-day festival, but this offers an opportunity for people to explore art in venues that they probably would not have been aware of previously. So in addition to the museums like the Nelson and the Kemper and the Toy Miniature Museum, the Jazz Museum, we also have historic buildings that were probably not on people's radar and that also have the opportunity to instill pride in the history of our city.
You know, I'm wondering if anyone does feel differently about Kansas City or a specific part of Kansas City than they did going into open spaces. Mo?
Yes, I do. Swope Memorial. I had never seen the actual Swope Memorial. And I went up there and I stopped some golfers in the Swope Memorial parking lot. And I said, so where's the Swope Memorial? And these two golfers were putting their shoes on. They said, well, we've always heard there was something on the other side of the clubhouse, but we never actually went over there. And it was not far away at all. It was like, you know, you could walk it in 2 minutes. And I go over there and it's this fantastic view of the park and this beautiful memorial. And Jill Downing's sculpture was up there, which was part of Open Spaces. And that happened several times to me that Ebony Patterson with the pool, I stopped her and I said, you should do a blog called Stuff People in Kansas City Don't Know About Kansas City. Because these were artists coming in from out of town that were discovering venues that I was not familiar with.
They were opening our eyes to things that are extraordinary to a newcomer, but that maybe because of history and bias and just entrenched patterns of behavior, we don't stumble across.
We go to the places we're familiar and we don't branch out as much as we should. And that was a wonderful part of the whole experience to me. And it took 2 months, you know, riding around and finding all these places. And it seemed to build momentum-wise. As it got towards the end, a lot more people were coming into the Belger with their apps and with their books.
Well, I want to play a clip now that is Chris Hernandez from the city of Kansas City, Missouri, contacted us this morning. And he was a little bit concerned that we might be evaluating this strictly from a place of numbers, how well things were attended. And here's what he wants to say about how we should evaluate open spaces.
You know, I think we sometimes get caught up in attendance numbers and the newest information, but I think with this particular project, it's important to go back to the beginning and realize that our number one measure of success is the fact that we staged the event itself.
Is just the fact of having pulled it off, April, to you, is that a measure of success to you?
I think that's one measure of success, yes. And I do think that they did accomplish that goal. They did get these installations up. It was an excuse to get out and experience these things. I did see people out there, and they did bring these artists in. There are other ways to measure success, too, of course, but I do think that this collaborative that you described does deserve credit for pulling this off.
Mo Dickens, just thinking about what you said earlier on, that you spent, you know, you have a Wednesday through Saturday work schedule, and that beyond that, you invested a lot of time and energy. You're a person who works in the arts, who goes to art stuff all the time, even when open spaces isn't happening. And through all that effort, you made it to 90% of things. When you think about Kansas City on the whole, people who aren't as passionate about art going into it as you are, or who don't have 3 days of their week to devote, who aren't going to put in the kind of work, what do you think?
Well, I think that's normal. I still today get we did a show at Belger in 2005, and I had people from five different continents who signed my comic book on opening night. And yet there are people who lived there their whole life that wandered in during open spaces. And that's what brought them to Belger. But they came to see the Brazilian waterfall that we had on display as one of the open spaces sites. But once they got in, then they also discovered the Renee Stout show that we have that's all from the Belger collection. And that happened.
Something that lives here in Kansas City all the time.
Right. And so another thing, you know, talking about what Chris is getting at here, attendance is one thing, but then also social media spreads the exposure that we got. Like one of my visitors was Robin Cymbalist, who was the editor of Art News Magazine for years. Now she's this Instagram whiz with 40,000 followers, and she came to see the waterfall, but then she loved Renee Stout. And I had another artist from New York who said Renee was one of her heroes. And she came for open spaces, discovered Renee Stout, and when she left, she said, Renee is one of the reasons I quit my job at age 28 and went to art school and became an artist, I had no idea all this work was here in a collection in Kansas City. So we got exposure that way. And these people, Robin, with all her 40,000 followers, is posting pictures of our exhibit. That wouldn't have happened if Open Spaces hadn't happened.
So Kansas City's reputation as an art city grew through this.
Oh, yeah. We had, in the last couple of weeks of our show, we had a busload from the Baker Museum in Naples, Florida, from Salt Lake City, from Cincinnati. And those folks were, we get tours like this anyway, coming to see the Nelson, the Nerman, the Belger, the Kemper. But then you put Open Spaces on top of that, and they were completely blown away with the art scene here.
Let's talk now with Dan Cameron. Dan is the artistic director and curator of Open Spaces. And Dan, I'd love for you to respond to what's been said today.
Well, good morning, Gina. Hi, Mo. Hi, April. It's great to talk with all of you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please
yes,
go
Dan.
On.
Wonderful. Well, you know, thank you so much, first of all, for just, you know, making this such a high-minded discussion. I have to say that for me, as artistic director, now that I have like a couple of weeks, you know, of life after Open Spaces to reflect on it, I think of it really as a success, not just because we pulled it off, although that it's good that we did, but also because for me, I think that my whole experience as a curator, my whole life in art, let's say, has to do with these moments that I have had encounters in my life, whether they be musical, whether they be theatrical, whether they be in museums or outdoors, that I think of as sort of, you know, sublime or transcendental. They make me stop and they make me kind of focused in a different way on what it really means to be a thinking, living, breathing human being in this moment, in this place, you know, in the world. And I know it sounds a little bit heavy, but I've wanted to make a project in which the maximum number of people, if given the right opportunity, would have those sort of encounters, would have those sorts of experiences themselves. And as artistic director, I, of course, was a magnet for all those individuals whose lives were touched by the artists and the projects in Open Spaces. But I can tell you, it happened every single day that I was off job, that Kansas Cityans were coming up to me and saying, you know, I never knew that contemporary art could speak to me in the way that it has. And so people who had never seen contemporary art in their lives came across it in one way or another, at Union Station, for example. And then plugged into Open Spaces, and then went around and saw all the rest of the exhibition or the stuff that they could, you know, given their time. Yeah. And they just came away feeling that their city was so fantastic, that this idea of contemporary art was so great.
I want to ask you, you know, are there any hard questions you're left wrestling with as you think about, first of all, whether you're going to do it again, and then secondly, how? Like, will you do it the same way? Did you learn something from this? Are there adjustments that need to be made?
Oh, of course. There are adjustments that should be made. And to answer your second or first question, if asked to do it again, I would say yes in a heartbeat. I think that what happens when you try to do something the first time like this is you really go as far as you can to give something for everyone. You know, you try to please everyone. And because this was a public-private partnership, as you pointed out, you know, making sure that, you know, the mayor's office and the city as a public entity, as a governing entity, was reflected well in the content of the project, but also that the private philanthropists who really gave most of the material support to Open Spaces, that they felt proud, that they felt that the caliber of the work involved was enough to have warranted the contributions that they made. So I have to say, on both of those scores, everyone came away happy. For me, now in retrospect, I think I would maybe have said, just for example, yes, we have 10 weekends for Open Spaces, but do we need to have every single weekend with performances at SWOPE? You know, we did this to make sure that the mayor's original idea was, you know, was adhered to, was honored. But I feel like in the end, like, well, that was a lot of work and a lot of effort. And maybe 6 weekends instead of 10 would have worked just as well, if not better. Those sorts of things, I think you can really think about.
Well, Dan Cameron, thank you. And we'll be doing more follow-up, I'm sure. But it's been great hearing from you today. And thanks for all the work you put in.
Well, thanks for having me, Gina. And thank you to everyone in Kansas City for playing.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks to your staff, too.
Well, and that brings us to the end, but thanks also to Mo Dickens and April Fleming. You've both been great sharing your insights.
Thank you.
You can listen back to anything you missed from today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how local comics creators are taking the news of Stan Lee's death and how his influence can be felt in their art tomorrow at 10. If he influenced you, tweet us about it. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior editor. I'm Gina Kaufman.